Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to An Hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we are going to be discussing a subject that I have found absolutely fascinating, and my guest is one of the authors of a publication called The Suppressed History of America. Now, this is going to be about the murder of Meriwether Lewis and the mysterious discoveries of the Lewis and Clark Expedition. And I would like to welcome Xaviant Hayes to the show. He is one of the authors. Paul Schrag was the other. And, gee, Xavier, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Donna. Thank you for having me.
Now, I mispronounced your name. It's Xaviant. You are an interesting person because you're a researcher. Now, you've traveled all over the world. You love to get into old manuscripts and various kinds of historical documentation, but you've also been involved with music. You've been a DJ, and you live right in my own home turf, Tacoma, Washington. That's really fascinating. And Paul Schrag also is in this area, but he is an award-winning journalist. He's written novels. He's been involved with marketing and business consulting, and he, like you, has been involved in music quite a bit. He's also a photographer. How did the two of you fellows ever get together?
Well, Paul covered me first because I was working with Josh Reisberg, a local MC from Tacoma, who's one of the more famous award-winning poets from this area, and I happened to be producing his first album. And Paul interviewed us for the Weekly Volcano. And that's how I met Paul.
Mm-hmm.
The book came about because I had visited the Theosophical Society, and I was talking with the hippie who worked there, and he started mentioning about, you know, red-haired Indians, and he gave me a book called America B.C. by Barry Fell. And when I read this, it just, you know, it sparked my hunger to learn more, you know, about pre-Columbian visitations to America and just basically the history they're not really teaching us. You know, I've always had a passion for history. Like, I've always been into Stonehenge and so forth. So that reading that book by Barry Fell kind of sparked, you know, this passion, because the original idea was, well, I wonder what Lewis and Clark might have seen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of just led me down the path. And Paul, who is an excellent journalist, once I had an agent and there was some movement on the publishing front, I asked Paul to help me co-author it, to strengthen it up, because he's a far better writer than me, for sure.
Well, you have a gentleman, Michael Tsarin, who wrote the foreword to your book, and he was born in Northern Ireland. He also has a passion for history, but he himself is an expert on what he calls occult histories of Ireland and America, and he's written a number of books on that. But I was intrigued with his foreword, because in the very beginning, he says, and I'm going to quote it directly from your book, If it flies in the face of convention, suppress it. If it contradicts accepted academic dogma, reject it. If it opens minds, condemn it. If it turns history upside down, make sure it never sees the light of day. So has it been down through time. Boy, is that the truth. In 1423...
Wow, isn't that powerful? Yeah, Michael Tsarin.
Yes, I mean, it's amazing. 1423, the Chinese emperor that came into power destroyed all, as much as he possibly could, of all the maritime history, explorations, and everything that had been done by some very powerful people in China because he had come into power. How many times has this happened throughout human history, where things have been deliberately destroyed?
Many, many times. Think of all the incredible knowledge was lost in the libraries of Alexandria in Egypt.
Absolutely. And look at what Hitler did. He went in, Stalin, the same thing. They destroyed everything. They didn't want people to know. So the first thing that goes whenever any despotic environment comes in is the written word. They don't want people to think. They don't want people to learn. They don't want them to know. And then they like to make up their own history. And he brings out some information about the Smithsonian, and just in reading the foreword, your interest is piqued, because this is a story about how things have been suppressed, and of course, any of us that watch the History Channel or have a love of history ourselves, we're finding so many people, just like you and your associates, have decided we're going to dig a little deeper. Look at the Kennedy materials that have just come out. I mean, and these were locked away for so many years. Now they're exactly. becoming public. So here you are with this, and you are beginning this journey regarding the journals of Meriwether Lewis. Now, did you actually see these journals? Did you read them?
I read what I could. I physical copies, you know, the historical ones. I haven't seen, but I read basically everything that's available to read, including the rare Nicholas Biddle versions, which were the original versions, and all of John Patrick Gass's work, which is, people don't even know about that, and that's where we get most of the important information.
Now, with this, there's a statement in here, Thomas Jefferson chose Lewis and Clark to do this expedition because America was really going to be growing and expanding in its land. And this is something that you cover in this. But the quote by Jefferson that's right in the introduction, said he said, it's impossible to find a character who, to complete science in botany, natural history, mineralogy, and astronomy, joined the firmness and constitution and character prudence, habits adapted to the woods and familiarity with the Indian manners and character requisite for this undertaking, all the latter qualifications Captain Lewis had. This was a very well-educated and experienced person.
Yeah, absolutely. Meriwether Lewis was a man of a breed that they don't even make anymore. He was from a very high, you know, aristocratic family, and his mother was like one of the most famous and first botanists and herbalists of, you know, in America, basically. And he grew up, in tune with nature, in tune with the herbs, in tune with his own sort of, I guess, psychic intuition, even though that wasn't really prevalent back then. And not only was that, but he had, I mean, he literally grew up within a stone's throw from Monticello. And, you know, Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson watched Meriwether Lewis grow up, and he was pretty much his appointed protege since childhood. So he was highly educated in all forms of the sciences available to in his days, because he wanted to learn. And he really had a passion for knowledge that I share, and a lot of people in this age of revealing share.
Now, you go into the history of the Olmec civilization. Why was this so important for you to write about?
The Olmecs are one of the greatest mysteries of the whole Western Hemisphere. And I thought it would be important to put that in the first, you know, first chapter, to kind of open the doorway for alternative thinking. You know, once we realize that this strange culture that's supposed to be the mother culture to the Mayans and everything, they had huge African stone African heads, incredible hieroglyphs, some sort of written language, all these crazy mysteries that I figured, well, if it's here in South America or Central America and Mexico, how can we find evidence of this also in America? Has just the point of, you know, when the Spaniards came across, this whole area was open. So I figured the mysteries of the Olmecs would be a good little starter. And plus, no one really knows about them. So I figured that, you know, in a book that people are expecting to read about, you know, American history, you know, put a little extra something in there they might not be familiar with, and it'll take them down a whole other path.
Well, the very last question, or actually two questions, in that particular chapter about the Olmec, which is quite interesting, you're wondering about this possibility of influence in North America, and did it exist during the journey that was made by Lewis and Clark? Obviously, it was at a time when there was hardly any development or what we'd call civilized environments. It was pretty rugged.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
They were dealing with the elements at their extremes. So you also touch upon Florida, the Fountain of Youth. You go into the Miami Circle, and then
which
you
I just visited recently, by the way, and it's basically completely covered up. A hotel was built around it, and there's really nothing remains there. Like a tiny, they're trying to do a tiny little park, but it's a travesty, really, what they did to that place.
Well, that's an interesting point. But you also go into the Mound Builders in Mississippi. Now, Lewis and Clark had to have been able to see this. DeSoto, who was one of the early explorers, he saw it. And this is something that they're beginning to realize has a lot different, there's very different applications than what was originally thought. But you, with that, you go into, and this was, of course, at about 1804, you could talk about the different tribes, the Choctaw, the Creek, the Cherokee tribes, and all of these different people that were living in the area. When Louisiana Purchase was done, and I think that was 1803, then this was important to go through and find out about the land. But there was a little bit of what I'd call, what do I want to say, a specific agenda that Jefferson
Absolutely.
Had in mind that was, in my view, not ethical, but that's what he did. Tell us what that was.
Well, you know, that's the other half of the coin, is the figuring out, you know, once they figured the land and the routes, and the other part would be, you know, which is not talked about or done in the negative light, of course, is what to do with the Indian, the native Indian population. And a lot of the Indians they had wars with, of course, too. So, yeah, there was a whole other agenda for figuring out how to eradicate the Indians and rounding them up and basically steal their land and do it in a way that didn't really make everybody mad. And that was another half of their agenda, at least from Jefferson's point in the government part. Mm-hmm. Lewis and Clark, they were, you know, obviously they were aware of that coming problem, but those guys were explorers. They were interested in seeing what was actually there. I mean, you got to understand, no one even expected them to survive,
mm-hmm.
which is a miracle in itself that they did. And the Indian, the Mandan Indians, I don't know if you read about them.
Well, I went through your book, yes.
Okay, well, the Mandan Indians are the most mysterious and crazy of all the Indian tribes, and they represented something that, you know, Lewis and Clark had a conundrum trying to explain, because they were given specific orders to look for the Welsh Indians, right? And
mm-hmm.
when they came across the Mandan, they were absolutely sure they had found evidence of that, considering how the Mandans designed their streets, their villages like streets. They lived in weird houses. Their legends, you know, they had a whole myth of Atlantis, which, you know, they were the only tribe that had this legend. And they had dances and Christian mythologies and symbolism that, and plus they were, some of them were white, or at least whiter, and had blue eyes and blonde hair. And all of this bugged out Lewis
mm-hmm.
and Clark a lot. And it's really sad that the Mandans are, you know, they're lost and nothing remains. And, you know, in the book, in the chapter, I basically tried to, did my best to make sure that they're preserved, or at least their legacy and some of their memory is, because they were amazing. And Lewis and Clark even say that all of the Indians and everyone they met, no one stood out more than the Mandan Indians.
Well, it's so intriguing because there's more and more research that's coming out relative to the Chinese having been in North America long before Columbus got here, And the African peoples had been over here, and there's records coming up in South America. I'd say over the last 10 years, they're finding more and more artifacts and monuments and other things that say, wait a minute, this is representing different peoples that supposedly didn't even know how to rub two sticks together. Excuse me.
Have you heard about Robert F. Marks, the famous archaeologist? He found off the coast of Brazil Roman canopies jars and in the 70s, basically, and they told him, they locked him, they threw him in jail first, and then they told him, you know, never come back. And now it's pretty much illegal to even dig or look for those artifacts when it's right there off the shore.
All of these different mounds that Lewis and Clark discovered, there's so much here in your book that you've done research on. And going back, stepping a little bit regarding what you just mentioned, in 1625, there was an Archbishop of Canterbury who wrote a world history saying a Welsh prince had discovered America. These things are really interesting because you just find all kinds of materials that are coming to the forefront. Maybe they've come from private libraries. I'm sure in the Vatican, in their libraries, they've got bushels and bushels and bushels, tons, actually, of materials that haven't seen the light of day for a long time that are protected. They have all kinds of historical information in them.
I couldn't even imagine what they actually have. And then, you know, obviously learning how to read it is a whole other issue.
That is true. Now,
one thing I discovered about reading all the old stuff, you know, especially relating to, you know, 1700, 1800 in history and the writings from that period, is how dumbed down our knowledge of language is today. I mean, and there's words I can't even begin to comprehend. And I challenge anyone to go and read some of that stuff and see what you actually really know and then compare it to what we know now. It's incredible.
Yes, there's so much that has actually been destroyed that fortunately some researchers are beginning to find the remnants, the little tidbits that are still available. Let's come to the Pacific Northwest, which is our home turf, and you found that the Pacific Coast really held a lot of fascination for Lewis and Clark, and of course Sacagawea was very, very important with her travel. She was a very, very special lady. There was the Kennewick Man. You've got a chapter devoted to this particular situation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Kennewick Man was discovered, top of my head, I believe in the either 70s or 80s, and he was basically a red-haired, you know, Scottish-Irishman, and it caused a huge controversy because he is definitely older, at least 10,000 years old. So then there's this huge controversy, and then the local Indian tribe there wanted to claim it and give him a proper burial. But once they discovered that he wasn't really Indian, the army sequestered it and fought him in court and tried to keep it from, you know, doing any more studies. But then what they found out that he wasn't really even Irish or Scottish. He was actually part of the ancient Chinese people known as the Ainu. And these were, I mean, really, really old, which you would consider almost Bronze Age or ancient Chinese before, like what we're even familiar with. And so they pretty much discovered that they had been traveling over here, naturally, across the Pacific, even way, way, way back. So to find him was a reaffirmation of all the possibilities and the facts that, you know, we found ancient Chinese coins in Cannon Beach. The horses that Lewis and Clark found, you know, once they came out of the Bitterroot and they got the horses there from the Nez Perce, they were a breed of Chinese horses, like racing horses and thoroughbreds. And there's no way that those horses could have been that finely you know, possessed by the time the Spanish so-called introduced him. And you can find petroglyphs and ancient art of the Chinese descripting these horses, which they're actually kind of a combination from Saudia, the horses in the Saudi Arabia, and they went up through ancient China, and they developed their own little stock, and it came across into the Pacific, and the Nez Perce were the ones who were responsible for looking after this and breeding them, and, you know, they were the finest horses of the land. And another thing that's forgotten, and this didn't make the book, I tried to get it in there, but, you know, the editing process, what can you do, is that, you know, Lewis and Clark were, Nez Perce, Chief Joseph, they were the first to see, first white men they have seen. But before, during the Trail of Tears, when they rounded up Chief Joseph and everybody, mm-hmm. when they searched him, they found that in his little medicine man pouch, he had a 6-inch Sumerian tablet from ancient Iraq.
Sake.
Yes, and, you know, when they asked him about it, he said that it was given to him by his ancient forefathers by, you know, the white men from across the sea. And that was a fact that got left out of the book. I was kind of mad about, but it's there, and you can look for it. It's incredible.
Well, this is what you call suppressed history of the United States. And one of the points that's brought out in the book is that there are museums like the Smithsonian and others that have got artifacts and information that are archived. It reminds me of the scene in the Indiana Jones movie where the Ark of the Covenant, when that movie was out, was put in a box labeled government a warehouse somewhere. And in the movie, the warehouse just seemed to go on for miles and miles and miles.
Yeah.
And was put, and nobody would know ever where to find it. And I wonder how much is actually in warehouses that might be under the government or with the Smithsonian or major museums. I mean, I'm aware, for example, of the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. My goodness, they've got so much artwork that it'd take you 11 years just to go through the facility itself, and they've got stuff that is still in their basement, if you will, that they can't possibly bring out. I mean, there's just so much, and nobody even knows really what's there unless they've been around the museum for a long time and know where all the records are. It's just amazing how things can be stockpiled. And you bring that out in your book.
Yes, absolutely. And the rare little artifacts that kind of remain are in little small towns or out-of-the-way places. You really have to, you know, boots on the ground and make an effort to go see.
Mm-hmm. You bring out how there have been discovered coins bearing ancient Hebrew iconic writings, and this was found in 1952, and artifacts have turned up in Tennessee, in Kentucky. There's a Roman item, and there's just Indiana. They found something from a bronze coin from Claudius II. I mean, all of these different things. And this is part of your suppressed history of the United States. Of course, you just weave it with all of these different stories. But one that captured my mind was about Sacagawea and how she stayed with the Lewis and Clark team. She actually went to the East Coast and allowed her son to be raised by Clark. And then she went back to her village, gave birth to a little girl, and then she died from an unknown illness.
Ain't that crazy?
What happened to the child?
He was brought up by Clark and given a full education.
Wow.
And
that is amazing.
It's amazing, and what's crazy is, like, okay, Sacagawea, the miracle of, like, the reunion with her brother basically saved everybody's lives. So that in itself was an incredible miracle, but it happened. And then the fact that she wanted to continue on the journey. She didn't even need to. So she
a
went
sad
with them.
Thing.
And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, she went with them, and then when they got to to have the historic vote, you know, of where to spend the winter, You know, it was the first time in American history that an Indian, a black African American, and got to vote on equal terms.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, their journey was historical from many, many different angles. The one thing that I had kind of have a beef with Clark about is he didn't give York his freedom when they returned. And that kind of didn't sit well with me.
Yeah. That was his slave. And
yeah, York was his slave from childhood. Like, they practically grew up together.
Yeah, but he wouldn't give him his freedom. It's not unlike Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson, yeah, they don't talk about that, do they? I mean, he was a great man and all this, but yeah, he had slaves.
Mm-hmm. He had a lot of them. And he eventually ended up selling them, which he said he was never going to do. But we're digressing there. Let's get back to Lewis, because you have a special section on him. You're covering the expedition. You're giving all kinds of historical information regarding North America, which I just think is absolutely fascinating. But when Lewis came back after the hero's journey of over 6,000 miles, he was thrown, in your words, into a hornet's nest that made the lands of the Louisiana Territory the original Wild Wild West. And it ended up causing his death, didn't it?
Absolutely. Really sad. St. Louis at that time, mainly because of the lead mines and the worry of war from Mexico and, you know, Spain and France and you know, revolutionary war heroes like General Wilkinson wanting to be like take over the government and you know, be the boss. So St. Louis was, really, really dangerous place. And when Lewis got down there, he was appointed governor, and he was full of ideals, and he was a noble individual. You know, he wanted to go clean the place up, so to speak, you know, like Wyatt Earp. And he found out that he wasn't welcome there. He really put the monkey wrench in a lot of plans and created a lot of enemies.
You bring out some historical information that I'm really intrigued with. When I think of what we're going through today, one of the biggest things that people are very upset about is the fact that we owe so much debt to the Chinese, and that they now have for collateral certain areas of the United States, and there's all kinds of commentary that is going all over the place. But when we go back in history, when George Washington was considered the first president of these United States, the Rothschilds were owed a lot of money because of the wars. And amazing.
Yeah, exactly. These are the facts that we don't get told about for obvious reasons. You know, Alexander Hamilton, who is on the $10 bill, why? You know, I mean, mm-hmm. How does that make any sense? Who is this guy? Well, Alexander Hamilton was one of the smartest men during that period, and he got George Washington's trust so much that Washington depended on him to get the loans in order for Washington to win the war. Of course, the loans by Hamilton were directly from the English banks. You know, he was their sole agent. And so no matter that the English lost the physical war, they had, with Alexander Hamilton's cunningness, they were able to gain control of the banking industry, which their manipulation of this and mastery of that is the reason why they were able to run things in Europe and in England and abroad, because they figured out this whole scam. And
mm-hmm.
I
was going to say, you bring out, talking about the banking system, you bring out the fact that Benjamin Franklin was very much against a privately owned central bank controlling the currency of the United States. He was adamantly against that. However, the first bank of the United States was set up in 1791 after Benjamin Franklin's death, and that was done by Hamilton.
ah, pretty weird, huh? Hey, at least they waited till he died because they knew they wouldn't have got away with it if he was living. Yeah, he even states the reason for the Revolutionary War was, the main reason was, you know, not the taxes and all the tea stuff that, you know, history tells us was real. The real reason was that they made it impossible for them to, you know, they had colonial scrip, which was their own money.
Mm-hmm.
So they outlawed that and they put this whole tax on them with the silver and everything, and basically made it impossible for them to print their own money and use the basic trading and bartering system that really is beneficial to everybody in the community, you know. And that was, you know, the reason why the revolution basically started, which would make sense considering, you know, if someone came in and said your money is illegal but you have to use this money now, obviously there would be a problem.
Yes, there would be. Well, and you also go into the murder of Meriwether Lewis, because he died on October the 11th, and it was a situation that was quite questionable, yet nobody was ever convicted, nobody was really held accountable. And things were sort of ignored because of the way things were at that moment in history. Well, you know, Zondian, we are out of time, and I want my listeners to know how they can find out more information. Your book, The Suppressed History of America, The Murder of Meriwether Lewis and Mysterious Discoveries of the Lewis and Clark Expedition, and even more, makes this book a real, real interesting read. I think it'd be great for kids that are in high school that would want to perhaps explore areas of American history they hadn't looked at. What's your website? Where can people go?
My website is Xavian Vision. That's Xavianvision, you know, vision.com. I have an online metaphysical library there. You can find a ton of information in all kinds of fields. And basically, if you just Google my name or go into Amazon, you try to get it for like $9 and, you know, it's there, and I love the fact that you'd mentioned the kids and high school kids, and because that's really what I do this for is for the youth. And
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If I can,
I think it's marvelous. I think that this is something that makes history fascinating for people.
Thank you.
And
thank
it
you.
Makes
and I wrote
course.
It because I'm aware in, you know, our society now and how, you know, reading is a lost art, and, you know, people really don't have attention spans anymore because the internet and everything else getting bombarded by this electromagnetic matrix that we're surrounded in. So I knew right away that if you're going to write a book, you can't write no 400, 500 page book anymore. It's just, you can't do it. You got to make it short, make it fast, make it entertaining, and get as much information as possible. That way, when people read it, they're going to be like excited and they're going to want to read the next chapter.
Well, Xavian Hayes, you have done that, you and your associate Paul Schrag. For those of you that would like to know more, check out the book, The Suppressed History of America. Go to Xavian Vision, xaviantvision.com. This is Donna Sebo. Xavian, thank you very much for being with me today. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Thank you so much.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. History is so fascinating to me. When I was in high school, one of the subjects that we had to take was American history. Well, as it turned out, we ended up getting a former Marine as a teacher. And even in my mind today, I can remember sitting in that classroom, and he was giving some information out. I don't even remember what he had been talking about. And one of the kids in the classroom popped up and said, I'll call him Mr. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, were you a Marine? The kid had somehow heard this. And he said, yes. And this was a tall man. He stood about 6'2", had jet black hair and thick, bushy black eyebrows. And he had a habit of sort of rubbing his hand across his face when he was thinking, when he was trying to come up with an answer. So he was doing this with his hand sort of going across his face, and he said, yes, I was a Marine. And so we asked him, of course, all of us who had been sort of noisy chatting in the beginning, the way all kids are when they go into a classroom, and we got all very, very quiet because we wanted to know what he had experienced. And he was asked, did you participate in the Korean War? Where did you go? Now, he had a lesson he was going to present, but he didn't present that lesson that day. He said, you really want to hear my story? And all of us went, yes. Well, for the hour of class that we were with him, we were mesmerized because he told his story from his experience, what it was like as a Marine, being in holes in the ground that they had dug out with shovels, and the holes were difficult to dig because the weather was so cold. And he described what went on, and I could tell, even as young as I was at the time, that he was trying to think very carefully before he spoke, because we were all so attentive. He knew we were really listening. That man, as a teacher of history, gave us something of himself, but more than anything else, he made us curious about what had happened, what had really gone on. And when I think of people like Xavier, who have taken the time to research, and this is someone that has a passion for going in and checking things out, this is marvelous, and this is what makes history come alive when we share these stories. So the Suppressed History of America is really a fascinating read because it goes into a lot of different points of information. We've got a caller. Oh, by the way, before I go to the caller, I want you to know that if you want to call in during the show today, the telephone number toll-free is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And all I need from you is your first name or initial. Let's show you how it's done. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, where are you calling from?
Hi, Donna. My name is Tina. I'm calling from Westchester County, New York.
Oh, I'm coming into New York next week.
Oh, really? Where?
Well, I'm going to be in New York City proper. I'm going to be in Manhattan. I'm going to be on a panel with the National Publicity Summit, and then I'm also going to be seeing people for private appointments while I'm there. It's going to be a real tight trip, but I will be there next Friday and Saturday.
Great.
Yeah, so if you know of anybody that might want to meet with me, just have them give me a call at my office, 253-582-5604, because I'm going to be there just for those 2 days.
Great.
Well,
okay.
Let's Let's get down to business with you, dear. The first thing that I'm looking at is you are going to be a mediator between situations involving 4 to 6 people. Now, it's not all at the same time. These are individuals that are going to be going through some particular challenges, and they're going to come to you like they would come to a mother or a confessor, someone that they feel that they can trust, and they're just going to be letting their emotions just flow. And when I'm watching you and I'm watching how they're interacting with you, I know this trust is very important, but you have to stay detached. Because one of the things that they're going to want from you is objectivity. They don't want really any bias. They want you to be able to sort of set facts in front of them. They need clarity from you. And this is what you're going to be able to give them if you detach emotionally. If you get into a bunch of emotional fondarol, you're not going to accomplish anything. It's just going to be adding fuel to a small little flame and make it into a raging bonfire. So you need to really realize that it's because of the trust they have in you and the beliefs that they have that you can discern things better than they can. And you need to honor that. And you need to be a good listener. And don't make any preconceived statements that you think just should come out of a box. No, no, no. You need to listen carefully because there's some very subtle things going on here. And I think that when you do express your opinion, you can clarify it by saying, when I'm listening to you, this is how I am hearing what you're saying. Is this correct? Sort of ask them to clarify for you if you have any confusion. And believe me, it'll make a big difference. And you'll be able to detach and give them some very good information and help them to become aware of some choices that they have indecisions, but whatever you do, don't tell them what to do, because it's going to come back and bite you. What you want to do is give them information, give them suggestions, and then ask them, well, how do you feel about what I've said? Do you think it gives you anything to work with? Something like that. Use your own words. But you'll be glad you stayed out of it. Being a
right.
good friend, being the confidant is wonderful, but you don't want to get in the middle of anyone's hornet's nest. And also, I'm concerned about you physically because I really think you're highly stressed. I think you're under
yes.
a lot of stress. And you've got to find a way to release that stress. Some people like to bake bread. Some people like to go out and walk 25 miles. Some people just like
right.
to zone out in front of a TV. You need to figure out what works for you because you need to unwind and you need to let go this heaviness that seems to just fill you. It's like it's around your heart and in your chest. It's just, you just feel heavy. And
right.
you need to be able to release some of that because it's not yours to carry. What would you like to ask me?
Well, I guess I'm so stressed out because it's been like 3 years trying to sell my house. I live alone here. And I have just recently, about 2.5 weeks ago, given it to a new realtor. This is number 5. And I've had so many people coming in and out of this house, but I'm really never getting offers. And I don't understand what's going on. I know the economy is bad, but
mm-hmm.
I'm hoping to sell it before next spring if I could. But I don't know what's going to happen now.
Well, I think you just need to relax about this. You're stressing
right.
over something you have absolutely no control over. But I would
right.
say this, there is a couple that is definitely going to be interested in your place. And the economy does have something to do with it. So
right.
you may find that there is a creative arrangement that is a possibility that you would be able to work out if someone had a good down payment that they could make. And who knows, it could be maybe doing something with a lease with an option to buy. Now, I'm not a real estate specialist, but I think you may
right.
need to come up with some creative, brainstorm with some people that are in real estate. So if you were in my situation, how would you want to approach this? What would you feel is the right thing to do? And, of course, you'd want to check the credit of the people. You wouldn't want anybody to come in that doesn't have good credit ratings, et cetera. But I think that the house is going to sell. And I do think that you may have another year, but there may be an option that you can work with that would enable you to move away, give you some money to do that, and then there'd be an occupancy in your house, and you're getting money every month. Now, this is going to take some creative financing, and it's all legal. It's not something that's not. So I really think you can do this.
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Just be patient, and I want you to just know that the right person is going to be wanting your house.
Right.
And that it's not going to be heavily complicated, and you're not going to get uptight over it.
Mm-hmm.
Just be grateful you've got a good, you've got a lovely home that's roof over your head, you're comfortable, and you know that you're going to be attracting that right person, that couple, that's going to want your home and will be very happy with the price and thrilled to have the opportunity to move in.
That's what I've been hoping for.
Well, don't just
hoping
hope.
For the right person.
Mm-hmm. Expect
to come
it.
Along.
Don't just hope. Yeah, just
right.
expect and just
expect
know it has to be in the right timing for them as well as for you.
Right.
And I want to thank you for your call.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
Bye.
This is Donna Sebo. Bye-bye. We're going to take a break for just a minute. And when we come back, I'm going to share a recipe or maybe a story or two. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. By the way, I mentioned to our caller who was calling in from New York that I'm going to be in the Big Apple next week. I'm going to be there on business and meeting with people, but the location that I'll be in is right there in Manhattan. And if any of you listening in New York would like to meet with me privately by phone or in person, call my office at 253-582-5604. And then for those of you in the state of Alaska, I'm going to be up in Fairbanks as well as Anchorage, and that will be coming up very soon as well. That'll be the 19th through the 23rd. So this is going to be a radio microphone that's going to be traveling to different states, and who knows where else or what else is going to be coming up between now and the end of this year. Can you believe how quickly this year's gone by? I'm astonished. It's amazing. All right, here in the Pacific Northwest, the temperatures have been dropping really, really, really fast. And it's that kind of crisp coolness that I just love about fall. I have to say that fall is my favorite season. I love the colors. I love all the changes that come with it. And, of course, here in the Pacific Northwest, you have to make sure that you remember that part of your heritage, if you live here long enough, is you become part duck because it rains a lot here. Well, this kind of weather, to me, is optimum for a good soup. And I have what I call my whatever soups, and that's whatever I happen to have in the refrigerator goes into the pot. It usually comes out pretty good. It's a great way to use up leftovers. But I came across a pumpkin soup recipe. And this is the time of year when pumpkins are everywhere, and it's a deliciously nutritious vegetable pumpkin is. You've got your beta carotene and so many other components in it. But this is something that is made up with spices. And soup is just so wonderful on cold, crisp evenings or even, you know, for lunch, whatever. I've known of people that have soup for breakfast. They really like it. And if you didn't know this, the number one soup, favorite soup of Americans is tomato soup. That is the absolute favorite. And by all the way to all the way. So if you make your own, that's great. Well, this is something that's a little bit different. But having had pumpkin soup before, and it's so good, when I found this recipe, I thought, wow, this must really, really be yummy. So here it goes. I wanted to share this with you. It's 2 teaspoons of butter, 2 teaspoons of butter. You need 1.5 cups of chopped leek. And the reason leek is recommended is because it's got a very delicate flavor. It's not going to be overpowering like a white onion. And make sure you wash it so that the sand is all out of the leeks. They're notorious for having sand in their soil. 1/2 cup of diced celery. 2 cloves of garlic, and you want to mince that. You will need 2 teaspoons of grated peeled fresh ginger. And you need then 5 cups of, you can use vegetable or you can use chicken broth or just plain water, whatever you prefer. But you're going to need 5 cups of a liquid. You need 3 cups of peeled, diced fresh or frozen pumpkin. Or if you're lazy like me, you're going to use 1 can, which is 15 ounces of canned pumpkin puree. I like going the lazy way many times. So, and then you're going to need 1/2 of a large sweet potato. And you want to peel that, and you want to slice it. That should be about 1 cup of sweet potato. And then you need 1 small piece of cinnamon stick and 1/4 teaspoon of ground nutmeg and 1/2 cup of dry white wine, 1/2 cup of evaporated milk or whole milk, whatever you prefer. Or if you like, you can use really, you know, use cream. Yes. Depending on what your taste buds like. 2 teaspoons of fresh lime juice, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, and 1/2 cup of chilled heavy cream. Okay, this is how easy this is. You're going to need a big pot. Put your butter in that pot. Heat it over medium heat. You're going to add your leeks, your celery, your garlic, and 1 teaspoon of ginger. And you just cook that until it's softened. It's going to take about 8 to 10 minutes. Then you take your broth, your pumpkin, your sweet potato, cinnamon stick, and nutmeg. Bring it all to a boil, reduce the heat, and you simmer it until the sweet potato and the pumpkin, all those flavors have blended. So that's going to be about 30 minutes. And then you take out the cinnamon stick, obviously. You're not going to want to keep that in. And if you have a blender, you can puree your soup working in batches. Or if you have that handheld blender, you can use that. Just be thoughtful about how you use it so it doesn't splatter over you because it's going to be very hot. And if you want a real smooth texture to the soup, you need to strain it. Then you return the soup to the pot if you want to strain it. If you don't, just leave it as it is. And I sort of like the chunky. And then what you do is then you put in your wine, your milk, your lime juice, and your salt. And you heat it until it's just beginning to simmer. And while it's doing that, you just whip up that cream, and so it's soft. Comes into soft peaks, and then you put the other teaspoon of ginger into that whipped cream, and you serve the soup with ginger cream. What about some nice crisp bread and a fresh salad? Wow, couldn't do better. Just yummy. Well, this is Donna Sebo. We're just about out of time. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about the Reiki man. We're going to be traveling to England to talk to Dominic James. This is a mystery of mysteries. We're going to find all about the Reiki Man, or Reiki Man, whichever way you like to pronounce it. This is Donna Sebo. Remember, always you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You have a magnificent day or evening wherever you are, and I'll be talking with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here at BBS Radio. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program,